Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSilicast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, April 26, 2015, and this is show number 520. Well, this is a really, really big week. I've got more to say about photos. I got the Apple Watch. We have NAB interviews to play. Now, the good news is that in spite of my best efforts to interrupt Bart, to chat across the pond is a little bit shorter this week, so you will not be listening for 12 hours like you were last week. You know, it's funny, I always worry about the show going too long, but I have never once had a complaint about the show being too long. I figure maybe you're like me. If it's too long, you just stop and you start up again the next week. That's what I do anyway. All right, well, we better dig in if I'm going to keep my promise, right? When Macworld was canceled, it left many of us very, very sad. Luckily, Barry Folk decided to do something to get us a place to go to enjoy our community. He is throwing a barbecue for all of the Mac fans who could get themselves to Chicago on June 20th. Not joking, and perhaps he's crazy, but he's actually doing this. He's throwing a barbecue for everybody who wants to come. Then another crazy person, Mike Potter from For Mac Eyes Only, decided it would be even more fun if we had a Mac conference to go to the morning of the 20th and go to the barbecue in the afternoon. So he has started a thing he's calling Mac Stock Conference and Expo. It's aptly named because it's in Woodstock, Illinois, about an hour away from Barry's house. Now, and did I tell you he's having the barbecue at his house? Well, anyway, Mike asked me if I'd like to give a tech talk at MacStock, and you know how I love to do that, so of course I said yes. Also speaking are Mike himself, Eric Erickson from For Mac Eyes Only, Chuck Joyner of Mac Voices, Julie Keel of Sci-Fi Talk, and Guy Searle of MyMac.com, and gosh, I think some other people just agreed to speak in the last couple of days, but I didn't write them down, so... Anyway, it is going to be a serious party. If this sounds fun to you, go to MidwestMacBBQ.com to sign up for the barbecue and find out about the hotel block Barry has for us nearby. Then head on over to MacStockConferenceAndExpo.com to register for MacStock. Of course, these links are in the show notes. I hope to see a lot of you there. Even Don McAllister is flying over from Liverpool for it. All right, second public service announcement. Donald Burr, creator of the original NoSilicast Live app for iOS, has been slaving away on a new version of iOS 8. I'm a big believer in incentives, so I've bribed him by offering to pay his developer fees for the next year if he gets the app submitted to the App Store by May 20th. If he's going to make that goal, he needs your help. He's reactivating the NoSilicast Away beta test network and needs more people to join in the fun. He especially needs people with older iPhones, 5S and below, and iPads, both full-size and mini, because he doesn't have those devices on which to test himself. Well, not to test himself, to test the app. Anyway, you know what I mean. If you'd like to join in the fun and help him out, please send him an email at dburr@borg-cube.com. Of course, there's a link in the show notes. And make sure you send it from your Apple ID email address, because he's going to need that in order to enlist you in this in the beta test. I do want to mention that when the app goes live in the App Store, all proceeds go to Donald's coffers, as he's the one doing all the work on this. I don't make any money off of it. This is Donald's hard-earned tears over his keyboard, so I hope you guys will all support him. Well, you know that old saying, behind every great woman is a great man? Well, that's definitely true in my case with me and Steve. On Friday, also known as First Apple Watch Delivery Day, he stayed home for 7 hours babysitting the doorbell, not for delivery of his own Apple Watch, but waiting for mine. Now, sadly, he ordered the Space Gray Sports version that within 3 minutes was backordered an extra few weeks, but he still stayed home just to wait for my watch. Now, I did have a good excuse. I went to the Downey School District to talk to the middle school kids about how fun it is to be an engineer. My friend Nancy asked three of us to go, who all used to work together. And I have to say, the kids were really receptive to the STEM topics. STEM is science, technology, engineering, and math. These kids are all part of a program called Project Lead the Way that's getting kids into the science fields. I kid you not, we saw sixth graders that were building and programming robots. I'm not kidding. So if you see Project Lead the Way in your kids' school programs, you make sure they go sign up for this because it's amazing. It's an elective course, and they were all over it. And one of the reasons Downey schools are so successful is because they have a benefactor, a wonderful 97-year-old woman named Dr. Mary Stauffer. She was a medical doctor, a pediatrician in her career, and later decided the best way to distribute her wealth would be to help fund programs in her local schools, including giant scholarships to kids who go to college from Downey. I'm talking like $50,000 a year she gives away to these kids to get them to go to school. I threw a picture in the show notes of Nancy, me, Dr. Stauffer, Lupe, and Jean so you can see how awesome Dr. Stauffer is. This woman still drives, you guys. She has got it going on. Well, anyway, this whole thing was supposed to be about the Apple Watch and how awesome Steve is, right? Well, sadly, he didn't even get the fun of opening and answering the door for the package because, of course, it came after I got back home from the school. Now, I'm sure that if you care at all about this topic, you've already seen unboxings and how cool the packaging is, so I'm not going to talk about that. I would like to give you my very early impressions of the watch. Now, remember, this is only after about 48 hours, so let's start out with the good stuff. The watch feels like it's part of me already. I don't even notice it's on. It's light and not as bulky as the running watch I used to wear. In case you haven't been playing along with our home game, I got the 38mm aluminum with a white band. I did complain after my first try-on appointment that the fluoroelastomer band sort of bulged out, but it turns out it doesn't bother me at all. I used to take my other watch off all the time when working at my desk or with my laptop in my lap, but the Apple Watch doesn't mind me at all. It doesn't make me want to take it off. Battery life is foremost on many people's minds. On Saturday, I played with it all day long, and by 6 p.m., it was giving me a 10% warning. I charged it just while I ate dinner, which was like 30, 40 minutes tops, and it was charged to 65%. So just for during dinner, I was able to get it back to where I could use it for the rest of the evening. Now, I'm sure that when I calm down, it's going to last a lot longer. I've seen people really worried about it going, oh no, it ran out of battery. Well, of course it did. So did your iPhone the first day you had it too, right? Everybody remember that? Anyway, we'll see how it goes. I did have trouble with charging the second night. It only charged up to 60%. It was 100% the first night. So I got to keep an eye on that. Maybe I bumped it during the night. This afternoon, I plugged it in. All right, you know, I set it on the charger and it charged up to 100%. So yeah, I'm assuming operator trouble, but let's keep an eye on that. I walk Tesla for about an hour every afternoon, and when I get notifications on my iPhone, I have to unzip my spy belt, untangle the wired headphone cable, pull out the phone, unlock it with my thumb, only to realize that notification does not need to be responded to right while I'm walking. Well, of course, none of them do, but you know which ones I want to. Anyway, when I walked Tesla with the Apple Watch yesterday and today, I got a nice little tap of the taptic feedback on my wrist and a little ding because I turned the sound on. I was able to simply lift my wrist and see the notification. But the best part is that I can tap reply and dictate right into the watch and either send my voice recording or the translated text. It works beautifully. I've had very few errors and it's so efficient and fun. I'm guessing that's why I burned through my battery so quickly the first day. I answered everything that came up on my walk. Chris Ashley of the SMR podcast said on his show that he'd give a kidney punch to the first person he saw talking into their Apple Watch. So you know who the first person I called with my Apple Watch, right? It was Chris Ashley. It killed him to admit it, but he did say in writing that the sound quality was really, really good. He's a good sport, and it was really fun having him get to be the first call. I had another good phone experience with the watch, something I hoped would work and did happen to work. We got into the car, I lifted my wrist, I pushed the friends button, tapped on Dorothy's icon, and then tapped the phone icon. The watch initiated the call without me having to remove my phone from my purse, but then the call automatically transferred to the car speakers and microphone because the phone was paired with the car. I realized later I could have actually said, hey, and you know the name of that service that I'm not allowed to say right after it, but now I can say it, Siri? I could have said that and then said, call Dorothy, and that would have worked too. I got to tell you, Steve says I've gone all Dick Tracy on him. I love it. I have another cool dictation anecdote. Dorothy's husband's name is Mark, and it's spelled with a C instead of the more common K. I answered a message from Dorothy using the watch and dictation, and in my response, I referred to Mark, and it spelled it with a C. I can think of no way the watch would know that other than in my contacts, I have her listed as Dorothy and Mark with a C. So the phone, watch, dictation, contacts algorithms all work together, realizing it should be spelled with a C. I think that's pretty cool. I'm sure you've all figured out that I'm sort of crazy about exercise. I love my Fitbit, especially the social aspects of torturing my friends about my stats. Yeah, Pat, you know who we're talking about. Anyway, but the Apple Watch tools are pretty awesome. There's two distinct applications. There's activity and workout. Activity measures three things. Exercise, which is defined as anything it deems at or above a brisk walk. And I'm assuming that some of the motion detection and your heart rate and things like that is when it decides whether it's at or above a brisk walk. So that's activity, or that's exercise. The second one is move, and that's moving around less than a brisk walk. You know, you get up and you walk downstairs to get some Cheetos, you get credit under move for that one. And then there's stand. Have you stood up at least once an hour for a minute, 12 hours of the day? So out of all your waking hours, they want you to have stood up for 1 minute out of each hour. And, you know, these things give you these cool little progress circles and help you to get more active. The stand thing is where I know I'm going to have trouble. I do these hard workouts, and I sit on my butt next to my computer for hours at a time, you know, writing up the carefully crafted show notes you like to read. Anyway, I do like how it taps me and it says, get up, get it, come on, come on, you've been sitting there, get up. Now, workout is completely different. So what I just finished describing was activity. Workout is different. In this mode, you tell it what you intend to do. So you can do indoor or outdoor, running, walking, elliptical, rower, stair-stepper, or other. So indoor running, for example, it will know that you're not going to be looking at the GPS, so it's not going to ask you about distance because you're not going to make any actual progress in terms of distance. But when you're outdoor running, you have an option about distance. It's an example about why it's indoor and outdoor separately. In workout, you set goals like calories burned, time, or distance. I used it on my run on Sunday morning, and it worked to motivate me more than my Timex running watch did. I could see at a glance how far I'd gone, how my split times were. Not good. You know, I've been vacationing a lot lately. I mean, I had Vegas, I had India, and I had we went to Santa Barbara wine tasting, so my split times are not so good. Anyway, it also gave me my full time on the run. I think the distance it's getting from the iPhone, which I did have with me, was somewhat borked, though. I think that I run 2 miles up the beach strand to this teal house, and then I turn around and come back. Should be 2 miles up, 2 miles back. And I measured that a while ago using Google Maps, and I've also measured it with my Fitbit, and it seemed to think I was going 2 miles if I went to the teal house. But when I ran with my watch talking to my iPhone's GPS, it said I'd gone 1.9 miles. All right, so the other ones are off. I would expect this to be more accurate. So I ran until it said 2 miles. So I'm now 2 miles from where I started. All right, maybe this can be more accurate. But when I ran all the way back to where I started, which, by the way, is in a straight line, so there's no chance of me having screwed this up, it said I had only run 3.9 miles to get back. Now, come on. If it's 2 miles out, it's got to be 4 miles total, right? I shouldn't say 3.9 miles to get back. 2 miles, 1.9 miles to get back. So anyway, it's not quite right. The good news is, though, that the step count was within 75 steps of what my Fitbit had recorded, so that's a good thing. The only thing I have to complain about is a rather big deal. The watch interface is confusing in some ways. Pat Dingler came over on Saturday, and we spent a lot of time comparing notes and trying to figure some things out. The confusion comes in where you go to set things up. You can set some things inside the watch, some things inside the Apple Watch app on the iPhone, and then there's also the settings on the iPhone itself which affect the Apple Watch. For example, if I turn off notifications for Twitter in settings on my iPhone, that turns them off on the watch. Now, I can turn them on for the phone and off for the watch using the Apple Watch app on the iPhone. I bet I've tangled you up right there, haven't I? And I'm talking about one of the ones that I actually understand how it works. I've had trouble, like, I can't figure out how to respond to a tweet that comes in from Twitter, but if it comes in from Twitterific, I can respond to it. And I know other people are doing it on the regular Twitter app, so there's some code I haven't cracked yet. Like I said up front, this is only 2 days into using the watch, so we'll see, but I'm a little bit worried about how normal people are going to figure some of this out. I put a photo in the show notes showing a notification that came from Twitter that shows how gorgeous the display is on this device. I tweeted out one of the NAB interviews with a photo in it of me doing an interview, and Steve retweeted it, so while I was on my walk, it came up on my Apple Watch. The photo is clear and brilliant, the text is gorgeous and readable, and it really shows you how this quote-unquote watch is amazing. Oh, I should mention, it does tell time, too. Well, last week we ran out of time on the show, so I did not get a chance to play any interviews from NAB, so let's rectify that right now. Normally, I post the interviews in order of recording, but I've decided this time to start with a couple of my favorites. If you have a GoPro or you know someone who does, you've probably taken a ton of video, but might be struggling with how to easily edit and produce interesting videos. Maybe you're a whiz at Final Cut Pro 10 and can afford that $200 to $300 price tag, or perhaps you've beaten iMovie into submission. But if not, how about a video editor designed for and by the GoPro people themselves? Now, before we listen in, remember all of the interviews are also available in video form over on podfeet.com. In fact, you can watch these videos ahead of time because Steve's posting them faster than I'm able to play them on the show. So let's listen to the GoPro interview, and later you can go back and watch it in action to see just how cool this really is. Well, a lot of people are buying these GoPro cameras and having a lot of fun recording video, but they get home and they've got all this content and they don't know how to use Final Cut, and iMovie's annoying as all get out. Luckily, the people at GoPro have a solution to this, and I'm with Craig Davidson, who's going to tell us about GoPro Studio.
Okay, yeah, we've developed GoPro Studio to address some of the issues that people with GoPro cameras have. Primarily, people record, a lot of times they just turn the camera on and just let it record forever. So you end up with clips that are hours long. Nobody wants to watch that. You have a couple of minutes in there that you want to find.
Oh, I'm going to interrupt you with one other thing I want to make sure people know up front. This is for Mac, Windows, and it's a grand price of free. So now I've got your interest.
Okay, yeah, it is free, and it's available on the website. Anybody can download it and play with it. And when you first start, you start in step one, interestingly enough, which is view and trim. You bring your GoPro footage into here, and it all appears in a bin on the left, and you can import from GoPro. You can import either MP4s or JPEGs. And if you did a time lapse, it'll turn the JPEG sequence into a time lapse video for you automatically.
Oh, nice.
The Hero 4 has a new feature, which is highlight tag, and you can tag video either with a remote with the iPhone app or by pressing a button on the side of the camera, and then inserts a tag into the video. And in view and trim, we actually show the clips that have tags, and we'll show a tag on the timeline so you can say, oh, that's the interesting point. I'll look there first.
So for that two-hour mountain bike down Haleakala, then you can find the one spot where you crashed and it was interesting?
That's correct. Or you're on the racetrack and that 20-minute session, you get to part where someone hits you.
Okay, so in view and trim, it's pretty much what you said. You can scrub through it, you can trim it, and then what do you do next?
Then you set an in and out point. You can rotate the image and do a couple of other advanced settings, such as change speed.
And the rotate image is good for when you've mounted it upside down on your dog.
Correct, either upside down on your dog, or I've mounted it upside down on my bike, just hanging it from the handle.
So it doesn't have to be a dog, good to know.
Right, that's right. So if you mount it upside down and didn't flip it in the camera, you can flip it here. And then once you've done the trim, it will create an intermediate file, which then you use in the edit room. The edit room has a similar setup. You have
So this bin on the left is not the same bin. These are the ones that have been edited?
These are the ones that have been trimmed. These are the trimmed. And this is actually a media bin for your edit. You have video, you can have titles, and you can also pull in music from your iTunes folder if you want to put music on your video.
So now we have what looks to be more of a traditional timeline. You call it a storyboard down here at the bottom?
That's correct. We call it a storyboard. It looks like a timeline, but the difference is that each time you drag a clip down there, it takes the same amount of space on the storyboard, and it just changes the speed in which it plays. So if you have a long clip, it'll play slowly through the thumbnail. If you have a short clip, it plays pretty quickly.
Oh, I see why you don't call it a timeline now. Yeah, I got you.
Speeding up there. And the editor actually has a couple of really nice features. In addition to the normal adjusting the view, adjusting the speed, it doesn't really depend. You don't have to set the resolution of your timeline of your movie when you start editing.
So if you bring in two different clips from two different resolutions, what happens?
It will actually set the timeline resolution to the most common, by time, the most common resolution.
So if I've got a whole bunch of clips that are 4K and then one clip that's 1080p, it'll do what to the 1080p?
It'll scale up the 1080p to 4K.
And vice versa, right?
Yeah, and vice versa. If you have a lot of 1080p and you're bringing a 4K, it will scale that down.
That's really cool. It does that intelligently.
Yeah, and it has it does that intelligently, so you don't have to worry about it. And then when you export, you can decide to export at 4K or 1080 or whatever. It will actually tell you the maximum for your timeline. It also has a speed change ability. And in this clip here, we have a snowboarder going over the edge of a pipe. And so we've stopped right as the snowboard's at the top of the pipe. We split the clip and then go over to where it's coming back down, split the clip again, and then take the middle clip, and we can change the speed and you can slow down the speed.
So you can actively make slow-mo video right in the middle of the clip.
Oh, that's correct. So you make a slow-mo video, and then as it plays, when you're in the editor viewing it, it just plays the frame slower, so it's a little bit, it stutters a little bit. But when you export it, it uses a feature we called Flux to generate the frames in between. So you get a nice smooth slow motion effect.
I don't think you can do that in Final Cut, can you? Steve shaking his head says not easily.
Not easily. That usually takes a plug-in to do that. But we build it in here because that slow motion effect is one of the things people really like about GoPro videos.
That is really, really slick. I'm watching you do this, and this looks completely intuitive to me.
Yeah, we hoped it is. We spent some time designing it. We're always working on things to try to make it easier to use.
Go ahead.
We also have these presets. So what we can do with presets, we can actually change the color very easily.
There's like filters like an Instagram kind of thing.
Correct. Yeah, they're like Instagram filters.
Yeah, I hate those.
Yeah, so you can have
these kids today, they like them.
Yeah, they like them, but there are a number of them. So day for night, and 1970s look, so your film's all old. And you could also create your own if you want.
Oh, cool.
Kind of fun.
Also, on the right-hand side, he's got things where he can change the white balance, temperature tint, exposure, contrast, saturation, sharpness, keyframes, a whole lot of other controls there. This is really, really slick. I still can't believe this is free. I mean, you're sure it's free?
Yep, it is free.
There's no trick. Sure, now, the final step is export. Anything interesting on step three?
With an export, you have a number of choices. For instance, well, if you've actually done a speed change, it actually gives you the option to apply flux to smooth it out.
So the flux capacitor, you do that, right?
The flux capacitor speed changing. It does take a lot of CPU, and so it takes a long time to export with flux, so we warn you.
It's doing a lot of math. It's interpolating between the frames, right?
That's correct.
Give it a minute.
Yeah. So there are just some presets for the modes, and you can always do a custom mode. In the custom mode, you can choose between H.264 or the GoPro Cineform codec, frame rate, quality.
Wow, Craig, this is fantastic. I especially appreciate the fact that Craig actually did this entire interview twice. I want to thank you for your time. This is fantastic. Where does somebody find this?
Okay, the software is found on the GoPro website under Products Software.
All right, fantastic. And what was it called again?
It's called GoPro Studio.
All right, thanks again, Craig.
Okay, thank you.
Like I said, I think that software is really, really cool, and I hope anybody who uses a GoPro can go down and get that. Well, I'm into week two with the new Photos app, and I am really digging it. My entire library did finally sync up from my Mac to iCloud Photo Library, so I could see all 58,820 of my photos over at iCloud.com. They also came back down in optimized versions to my iPhone. Oddly, though, while early in the week they were methodically plopping into my iPad, holes in the library started to develop. I'd have 4 photos in a row, then 20 blanks, then another couple. In some of the years, I'd be missing 80% of the photos. Now, traditionally, I spent a lot of time fooling around, trying to diagnose things like this on my own and noodling with friends on Twitter and Google Plus about it first, but I decided, why not give AppleCare a whirl? I always buy AppleCare on my portable products, but I usually only use it as a hardware warranty. I figured out, why not get my money's worth by making them figure this one out? Well, Alice took the call to start with, and I explained that I was really trying to exercise the limits of photos by cramming 58,000 photos in there. At first, she sounded like our kind of people. You know, she really appreciated what I was trying to do. But after a few minutes of searching for a solution, she said, "Well, it seems like you're just trying to do too much." I suggested that she was mistaken, since it works on the iPhone, and it works on the Mac, and it works in iCloud.com. And by the way, I'm paying $10 a month for 500 gigabytes of storage for these photos, so they better make it work. I was much more polite than that. I said, maybe we could push a little harder. She said, well, I could do some more research and maybe bump you up to a senior advisor. I suggested that would be a very good idea. I was very nice to her. I'm just making it sound funny. Anyway, Gerald, the senior advisor, got on the phone, and he was definitely our people. He loved what I was doing, and we noodled it back and forth for how to proceed. His first idea was to have me quit Photos on the iPad and turn off iCloud Photo Library. This brought up an alarming message, which I had looked at before, but it scared me, so I ran away when I was by myself. And because it said things like, I'm deleting all my photos and firebombing a nursery school. Well, that's what it sounded like anyway. But in careful reading, it was asking me if I wanted to remove the photos just from this device, or do I want to have them all downloaded to this device before turning it off? We chose to have them erased because I don't have 382 gigabytes free on that iPad, so that seemed like a good idea. Anyway, we said, go ahead and erase them off the iPad. After a bit of churning, it finished. But the photos were still there. The holes, parts of them, you know, it was a mess. We tried every off switch available, including turning off photo streams, and those photos simply would not go away. It was at this point that Gerald and I realized that I'd be doing a complete wipe to factory settings on my iPad that day. He did teach me something cool that I had really misunderstood, and maybe somebody else had, so I'm going to tell you about it, about running backups in iTunes. I thought you had to either have an iCloud backup or local backups. I thought you had to toggle one on and the other on in order to switch between them, but you couldn't be doing both at the same time. But like I said, I've been misinterpreting the choices in iTunes. Once you plug in your device and choose it in iTunes, you can see the backup section. On the left, you can choose to automatically backup to iCloud or this computer. That's where I thought you had to change it to this computer in order to manually back up locally, but Gerald explained, no, you can keep it backing up to iCloud, but still force a manual backup by pushing the Backup Now button. Like I said, maybe you guys all knew that, but I didn't, so I thought I'd tell you about it. Gerald suggested two possible paths after I made sure I had a local and an iCloud backup. Loved his backup plans. Anyway, he said I could restore from the backup first and then wait to see if all my photos came in when I turned on iCloud Photo Library. But that there's a reasonable chance that whatever was burgering it up, it might be in the backup file. And I might end up right back where I started, but having wasted a lot of time. The other option is to turn on iCloud Photo Library first and see if the photos come in properly. That meant I'd have to set up the iPad from scratch after that. I chose door number two on this because I think it's fun to set up a new device from scratch because it forces you to reevaluate what you really need on your device. You know, I like to say it's like cleaning out your closet. If you take out what you don't wear, you don't have any empty space. But if you take everything out and put back what you really do wear, you do a much better job and you get a lot of space in your closet. Same thing happens on your iPad, your iPhone, your Mac, your PC, whatever. Erase it all the way down, shut it all the way down, and start over. And it's amazing how much space you get. I'm happy to say that after starting from a clean iPad, all 58,820 of my photos show up optimized for iPad. I think this is so amazing. I love that I can now see every photo I've ever taken on my Mac, my iPhone, my iPad, and even via a web browser on any machine. It's really, really cool. I can't say this was the smoothest user experience to get the last device working, but it's good to know that even if you're a crazy photographer like me, you can get all of your photos into iCloud Photo Library and have them all available on all of your devices. Now, I actually haven't talked much about the day-to-day experience of using photos. I have to say it is positively awesome, again, to have all my photos on all my devices. I bought a 1 terabyte SSD in my MacBook Pro because I did not want to compromise on having all of my photos with me. Now I have them on my iPhone and my iPad, and I just love it. One unexpected consequence that both Steve and I have noticed is that we're discovering favorite old photos. I ran across the very first digital photo that I ever took. I just bought the Nikon 950, and I got a shot of Kyle and Steve out in our front yard. It's a favorite old photo I'd completely forgotten about, and it was perfect to drop into Facebook on Throwback Thursday. I've also noticed that I'm cleaning up my photo library even more than before because I'm viewing all of the photos more often. I tend to skim by looking for a specific year, but then I get kind of sucked in and I start noticing that, you know, I saved extra copies of the same photo or maybe three of the same thing where two of them could be tossed. I used to make three different sized images for making little websites, and so I have like a small, medium, and large version of a lot of photos. I can go through and delete the little ones now. It's really, really easy. Now, I should say, people that I tell them I have 58,820 photos say, oh, well, you know, you really need to go clean that up. But I got to tell you, compared to most people, I am amazing at keeping my library cleaned up. I just take a lot of photos. Now, compared to the ideal we all think we should be at, I do still think at it. But I am really, really good about barting my photos more than most people. I probably took 2,000 photos, maybe more, in India, and I've bartered those down to about 500. So it's not that I don't throw them away. It's that I just take a lot of pictures. Back in the day when my son was in track, I remember one day I took 450 photos on a single day at a track meet because, you know, you press and hold the shutter down when the kid's running by, wait for the good shot. So I do get rid of a lot, though. Anyway, I was really worried at one point because I saw a bunch of photos that there was no photo there. It had a white background with an exclamation point. I drilled down into them, and as I feared, the real photos were missing. Now, this would be catastrophic. I noted the names, you know, it'd say like IMG underscore 3278, and I opened up Aperture and did a search for them. In every case, the photos that were missing have been in folders in Aperture called Recovered Project. In every case, that photo was also missing at Aperture. Now, I never knew how these recovered projects kept getting created, and they'd also happen to have photos I know I already had in my library. So it's not that every photo in recovered project is missing, but every one that was missing on photos was also missing over in Aperture. But these aren't projects that I want, and I don't know how they got started anyway, but I was always afraid to throw them away because it was such a pain to go back and make sure I had every photo. Anyway, I'm still a tiny bit nervous, but I don't think I'm going to lose sleep over it because I think the recovered projects were mistakes anyway by the software, and hopefully I won't find that again. Fingers crossed that I'm right. Well, it's been chatted about that Photos does have the option to open a photo over an Aperture. But lest you get your hopes up and think this works well, I want to tell you that it's a dumb implementation. It moves a JPEG over. Now, come on, who on earth would want to move a photo into Aperture for editing? Who would do that and not want it to be a raw photo? Doesn't make any sense. But it did occur to me, you can export from Photos as a 16-bit TIFF, edit it over in Aperture or Photoshop Elements, which I believe is, I think a TIFF, 16-bit TIFF is nearly as good as using the raw photo. Victor Cahiao is in the live chat room. If he corrects me, I will let you know in a few minutes. Anyway, so you can pull that 16-bit TIFF into Aperture or Photoshop Elements, do the edits, and then bring it back into Photos. Now, there's one downside to that. That is definitely a destructive edit, not a non-destructive edit like we had before. And, you know, even if I just want you to think about it, that even if you're limited in Photos, you're not out of options. Now, I'm noticing a bit of buggy behavior with Photos. It's not the catastrophic kind, luckily, but a few things are annoying. The main thing I'm noticing is that I'm naming things. I'm giving it a title, and the names revert back. Part of it has been in album names. Remember, I was worried about my albums coming over from Aperture? Well, Photos put them in alphabetical order with the folder names, and I kind of wanted them in time sequence. Back over in Aperture, you could slide them up and down and put them in the order you wanted, and I had them in the right order, but now they're in alphabetical order over in Photos. Not a big deal. I figured I could just put the date in front of each name so they'd go in the correct order. You know, year, 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 month, month, date, date. This worked great. Till the names went back to the original imported names. I don't know why it did that. I know I changed all of them. I'm 100% certain, but the names have all changed back to the original names as they were imported. And this is, again, the names of the albums. I thought, okay, maybe I hallucinated that. But then later, I noticed I added titles to a bunch of photos, and many of them show no title now. Not sure what's going on here, but I sure hope it stops. There's one thing that's going to annoy the daylights out of me until I get it fixed. And I sure hope this is a bug, not a design choice. Let's say I'm on a long trip. Take a bunch of photos of the Taj Mahal. That night, I import all these photos off my memory card. And because I am just that organized, I delete the truly bad photos. I do like my first BART pass, right? I don't empty my memory card because I want them on the cards as a backup while I'm traveling. Yes, I'm also backing them up to an external drive as well. But, you know, you can't be too careful on a trip of a lifetime. So far, so good. So the next day, I go out and I ride an elephant. I add those photos to the memory card. When I plug it back into Photos, I have an option to only import the new photos. That's great and just the way Aperture would have done it. But Photos consider the discarded photos new again. Now, that means it's going to pull in the ones I actively deleted. And by the way, they are still in recently deleted in Photos, but Photos thinks I want them again. I do not think that's a logical way to present them as an option. Now, Photos does show me the photos on the card that I've already implemented, and I think that the deleted ones should show up there, but not under new. I'm going to have to pay way more attention when I'm importing now, and paying attention is not my strong suit. All right, we got a lot more, and I will be talking about Photos for a while, but let's cut it off and get back to some NAB interviews. Now remember, I said I'd be playing my favorites first, and this next one definitely qualifies. We were so excited about this product, Steve bought it for me for my birthday. Let's listen in. We're in the Audio-Technica booth with Brian Piper, and we are actually recording this on a Canon camcorder with an Audio-Technica transmitter and receiver. But I asked Brian whether, by any chance, they have something newer and cooler than what we already have. What are you showing us here today, Brian?
So what we've got here is our System 10 family. So we've got a couple different lines out of that, but this is the System 10 camera mount that we're going to be viewing here. The System 10 is actually operating the 2.4 gigahertz range, so we're kind of in digital world now.
Okay, so for the audio-only listening audience, this is a device that Steve can hook to the top of his camcorder, plugs into the audio input jack on the camcorder, and then right now what I'm holding on the old version is a big old pack with a 9-volt battery in it and a long cable, and it's kind of messy, and it's all analog. But now we're going to go digital.
Correct, yeah, exactly. If you can kind of see the transceiver here, it's a transceiver. It actually does both, so they're both talking with each other, which is really, really nice.
So he's holding a microphone that has no wires.
Exactly.
No battery pack, no thing hanging off it.
Correct, yeah. Everything is built inside here. It goes wirelessly through, connects right to your camera here, as you can see. You get the mount with it.
You got two antennas on this now. Why?
It's got diversity, so you have two frequencies constantly searching for each other. So it makes sure that you have the best, strongest signal possible.
So on my old unit, I've got a little A-B switch. You're saying this is going to switch automatically?
This is going to switch automatically, and it actually is constantly searching for the best frequency to be on. So if your option A goes out, it switches over to your option B immediately without any dropout. And then that A goes and searches for a new frequency.
Now, I know saying digital sound sounds really cool. What does it actually mean to us?
So basically, you're getting high HD quality sound. You're operating in 24-bit, 48K audio. So it's full HD sound. The other thing with that is, too, is we don't have an analog companion in there. So the analog companion kind of shrinks your frequency spectrum down a little bit. Sometimes it cuts off at like 70 hertz, and then it kind of cuts you off at 16K. Now we have a full 20 to 20 frequency spectrum here.
All right. I don't know what all that means, but Steve, did you have a question?
No. I know what it means.
But he knows what it means. All right, so now you've got, so you can buy this transceiver with a microphone.
Correct.
And the mount and the receiver.
The receiver itself,
on the,
yeah, exactly.
And how much is that going to cost?
So it's a $449.99 for the handheld, as you see here. And then you could do a body pack option with a lab mic. And the lab mic, actually, we do our 4-pin. So all of our lab mics or our head-worn microphones are going to work for it. It's a very simple, very easy click, and there's no twisting. You just pull it out to release the lock.
All right, very nice. Now, one of the problems we have is we're always searching for 9-volt batteries at the hotel because
we
burn through batteries. What have you done about that?
Very, very slick. We actually built in a battery for it. It's a rechargeable battery. You can kind of see on this one here, it runs off of just a mini USB switch here.
Micro
USB, exactly. And another really cool thing, too, is they make those body packs that you can use, USB, that you can charge it if you're trying to do something for 16 hours throughout the day. It does last an 8-hour battery, though, for continuous use.
Wow, that's really cool. Now, see, there's a display on it, too. What's that telling us?
So this one is kind of going through since I replugged this back in. It's turning on. The batteries are dead from yesterday, but it's going through and searching for either microphone, either the body set or the handheld right now. So it's searching for the piece to be on right now.
So what would Steve be doing with all those buttons?
So yeah, you can kind of see here, it's the system ID number. Now the system ID number is basically like digital gaff tape. So it pairs up on one of these guys here, either the microphone or the body pack, and kind of tells you that this is going with this one here. If you have, you can use up to 8 at one time if you needed to, which is kind of nice.
So that's how you can switch it.
Exactly, you can switch it. It's kind of like this one is pairing with this one here, and this one is going with that one. So you can kind of tell which one is on or which one's not.
I got you. Yeah. How about, there must be a battery in the microphone too, in the transceiver?
There is a battery in the microphone here.
Just twisting it apart.
This guy here. So it's just two double A's.
Well, at least double A's are easier to find.
They are easy to find and a little less expensive than the 9-volt, right?
And you can get rechargeables. I don't think they make rechargeable 9-volts.
Yeah, 9-volts, I don't think so. Yeah. I know they make rechargeable double A's, though, for sure, yes.
So good for the environment, too. All right, thank you very much.
Hey, no
Brian,
problem.
If people wanted to find out more about this, where would they... Oh, wait, one more question? No, we already did the cost.
Yep.
Yeah, where would they find these products?
You can go to any, B&H, Guitar Center, any of those guys. You can go on to audiotechnica.com for more information on any of that stuff as well.
Or through Allison's Amazon affiliate link, I bet.
Absolutely.
Huh? Oh, now we're talking.
Absolutely.
All right, thanks a lot, Brian.
Thank you very much, guys. Appreciate it.
We're really looking forward to using the new System 10. You know, like we said in the interview, it's got such big advantages. Improved digital audio, the audio channel switch, auto channel switching is going to help with interference we sometimes get on trade show floors. And I'm just going to seriously love not having any wires hanging off of the mic in that annoying box that I couldn't clip to anything anyway, and to have rechargeable batteries in the receiver unit. That's going to rock. At both of the last two shows, we've had to waste time running between hotels to gift shops in search of 9-volt batteries for those dumb little transmitter receivers. I imagine we'll take this rig out sometime soon to do some audio comparisons. We'd love to find a noisy spot with a lot of interference, so I don't know, maybe we'll go to a Best Buy and hang out in the AV section and have all the TVs and speakers blaring. Stay tuned for that fun. You know, I'm a huge fan of Audio Hijack 3, enough that I did a screencast of how to use it for screencasts online. The best part about it is how easy it is to experiment with and try new things. I was recording Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart a few weeks ago, and as often happens, I asked him, can you turn your input volume down because you're so much louder than me when I've got my gain cranked all the way up. I can't get as loud as you. He complains when I ask him to do this because the same input volume is perfect when he records his shows and he doesn't want to mess up his setup. And then he had a great idea. He suggested I drop in a balance block into Audio Hijack and shift the balance away from him and towards me. I'd never used balance before in Audio Hijack, but it's so easy. I just dropped it in, moved the slider back and forth, did a test recording. It worked perfectly. Now, what do you think I did next? I whipped open Clarify, where I had quickly documented the setup I'd created to record Chit Chat Across the Pond a few weeks ago. I replaced the screenshots with the new ones, showing the balance block and how I had it set. Slid a few things around on the graphic to make sure it was pretty, and I think I typed in a single line explaining to myself why I had put the balance block in. Then I hit the Evernote button to put it right back in my database of tutorials, and I was done. Boom. Clarify is always there for me to help remember things that I would easily forget. So even if you never want to help anybody else, I'd recommend checking out Clarify just for yourself. Head on over to clarify-it.com and give the free trial a spin. And be sure to tell them I sent you. Well, it's that time of the week again. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchatz. And we got a lot of security stuff to talk about this week, huh, Bart?
We do indeed. Also, I'm a little short of breath because I'm a little under the weather. So if I stop more often than usual to breathe, it's because my nose is all
going like this and it's really annoying.
Well, good.
It's not
all right.
That bad.
Where should we start?
It's only been a week's worth of stories, but it's been a bad week for mobile security. So I've assembled mobile security news into a security medium up top so we can talk about it in more detail. There's some subtleties to discuss. So the first of the mobile security bugs we want to talk about is an issue with some implementations of WPA. So we all know that WEP is evil, and WEP is evil because the actual protocol is flawed. So it's not that someone has implemented it badly, it's that the whole idea was rubbish in the first place.
Okay.
WPA is not rubbish, but an implementation has been found to have a nasty bug in it. And in specific, we're talking about WPA Supplicant, which is the WPA implementation used in Linux, Unix, and that includes Android, which is Linux.
Ooh. So what is this supplicant thing?
It is the software that allows Android devices and Linux devices to actually talk WPA. So literally, if you can connect to a WPA network, you probably have WPA Supplicant on your Linux machine or your Android.
Okay.
So in other words, all Android. Because what Android device doesn't have Wi-Fi?
Right,
be it a tablet, be it a phone, they all have Wi-Fi. Linux servers that don't have Wi-Fi are not affected, but if you're one of the fairly small number of Linux desktop users, hello, NiWise, and you have Wi-Fi, you're affected by this too, most probably. So the actual library has been patched.
Oh,
so that's the first.
That's good.
So it is now a case of getting that patch to everyone. So if you're a Linux desktop user, that's probably very straightforward. You run yum update or apt-get update, and away you go. The problem is, of course, that in the Android universe, if you're not using an out-of-the-box Android straight from Google, you kind of have to wait for processes to happen. You have to wait for, I think it's the manufacturer first and then your carrier to all decide to pass this on to you. I hate it.
So how far back does this supplicant problem exist? I mean, is it affecting all versions of Android or just the latest one?
As far as I can tell, it's all the way back. Now, I don't know that for certain, but there is no one has mentioned any sort of limitation. It's a fairly fundamental bug, so whoever wrote WPA supplicant forgot to do a bounds check, so it's a buffer overflow. And it's a buffer overflow on the name of peer-to-peer wireless networks.
So what buffer overflow allows you to do what to somebody on Android then?
Well, in this case, it's a buffer overflow that allows for three things to be done. Either memory disclosure, which is where an attacker gets to see into your RAM, which is not good. Plain old denial of service, as in can crash your phone remotely, or can run arbitrary code on your phone.
So all the really bad stuff then?
All the really bad stuff, yes.
How does the attack vector, how would that happen?
I mean, they would create a Wi-Fi network that has a maliciously crafted name.
Okay.
Your phone would scan for wireless networks and in the process get hacked.
So everywhere you go...
Right. Now, so another complication that we have to mention, which is why it's in Medium, is that there is some open source software on Windows which also makes use of WPA supplicant, because it's free code. Why reinvent the wheel when you can just take WPA supplicant? So there may be Windows apps that are going to need updates too. Just to really make people
feel
happy.
But at least that doesn't scare me nearly as much, because if I've got a Windows box, I can push update. And an update's even going to come in by itself probably and say, you need to run this update, and that's going to be fine. It's the Android users.
Yeah, the Linux users are fine too.
They've got to fix that. That's just...
Yes, having all those middlemen in the way of security updates. I guess I can understand that if you want to rebrand that, you want updates in turn. You want to get in the way of things that look different. But you shouldn't be in the way for security stuff. That should just go straight.
Yeah, yeah. And...
Yeah, big problem.
So many people vulnerable. Okay, all right. So if you're running Linux or Windows, keep an eye out for an update. And if you're running Android, stick your head in the sand and scream.
Well, no. Right, if you're getting it straight from Google, which I think if you're going to run Android, you should run straight from Google. So I think they're the Nexus devices go straight from Google.
Oh, yeah. Well, maybe that's another reason to try to buy from Google directly, right?
Yeah, as long as you're running, stock Android, then you get updates straight away. There's no one in the way. And Google have fixed this. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's the good news to take away. The next vulnerability is utterly unrelated, even though it sounds scarily similar. Completely different software, completely different problem. Very similar symptoms. And this one affects iOS. And it's
Everybody's screwed today. That's awesome.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, this
everybody
is
can play.
Opportunities. Yeah, Apple's opportunities mess up. So no iOS zone is what this is called, because again, by setting up a malicious wireless network, now in this case it's not the name you have to mess with, it's the security certificate you install onto the network you have to mess with, and you basically set it up in such a way that you know it's going to trigger this bug, and it will then send any iOS device that comes into this wireless network into an infinite reboot loop.
So that just sounds annoying.
Right. At the moment, it is always possible with anything like this that if you can make it crash, it may be possible that you can run arbitrary code if you keep at it long enough. At the moment, it seems to be, quote-unquote, just crashing. The solution, by the way, is to get out of the area and the problem will stop, because then it will go away.
I just picture somebody in Starbucks running outside going, and then it fixes itself.
So no iOS zone. It's literally, you could set up a malicious access point and just knock out iOS.
Huh.
Which is interesting. Now, the slight ray of good news here is that the people who have found this bug are practicing responsible disclosure, so they have not said how to do this until Apple get a chance to fix it.
Okay.
So that at least is something. Then, also on iOS land, there are two entirely unrelated. There have been two sets of bugs found in groups of iOS apps. So this is not a problem with iOS. And it's not really a problem with the specific apps. It's a problem with some apps that have decided to use a particular third-party library. In this case, one called AF Networking. And what these apps use AF Networking for is to do secure communication with their back-end servers. They use it for HTTPS. So if you could imagine a Twitter app has to talk back to Twitter, that kind of communication should be secured.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what I would say is... Apple provide you APIs for that. Why on earth are you using a third-party library? But the chances are this is people who are porting code they have from something else into iOS.
So
I couldn't be bothered changing. Yeah.
Right.
So just bring the library with you. And the issue, so the first issue was found in an old version of this library. So this would only affect apps that were not being kept up to date. And that only affected about 1,500 apps in total. And really, the only one of those that caught my eye as being perhaps used a lot is Citrix Open Voice Audio Conferencing. Mm-hmm. But even that's probably not that popular. So it was kind of a ho-hum story. But then the same security team kept on attacking AF networking and found that there was another bug in a much more recent version that was, in fact, only patched this week. And that affects 25,000 iOS apps. But again, so the reason this is a security medium is because all we can do is wait for an update. There is one small other thing we can do.
Well, wait a minute. An update, does that mean all 25,000 apps need to update?
Yes, it does. Because each app has its own copy of AF networking bundled in. I really think you shouldn't do that. I think you should use the iOS APIs because that way Apple can fix the problem and you don't have to do anything as a developer.
So that's a good PSA to the developers, but to Allison George.
For Allison or what George, do we do? I have two pieces of advice. So first thing is if you have an app that you put information that you are worried about, the researchers who found these bugs have created a little search page where you can put in the developer of the app and it will list the status of their apps.
I got hundreds of apps, Bart.
Okay, but do you put stuff you care about into hundreds of them?
Okay, so I mean, start with Crown Jewels, work your way down. Huh?
Right, start with your banking app and work your way from there.
All right, right. Hey, not to throw you off your game here, but backing up a little bit, I don't remember if you said something that I saw in the show notes, and I want to make sure it was in there. The no iOS zone, which was the previous thing you were talking about, did you actually say that that this has not been actually disclosed?
I did say that.
Okay.
What I didn't say, looking at my own show notes, is that the guys have not said how they're doing it, so they are doing responsible disclosure. But what they have said is that the problem exists in iOS 8.3, but it's not as bad. They haven't explained what that means, but they have said that although it's not fully fixed in 8.3, you should go there because you're not as vulnerable as if you don't.
Okay.
So that's a bit cryptic. But there you go. So that's basically the state. That's the week that was in mobile phone news, basically. All bad. So to cleanse our digital palate, I figure we should do this to lighten the mood. So I love John Oliver. I've always loved John Oliver. John Oliver took on one of my biggest pet hates, which is patents. So I have stuck a link in the show notes to the 11-minute long segment from his show, which I think is This Week Tonight, I believe is the name of the show.
Yeah, so last it's the full week, segment. Next Tuesday or something like that, yeah.
Yeah, so it's the full segment where he takes on patents, and it is every bit as funny as you would imagine it would be.
Did you see the thing he did with Snowden?
It is literally in my YouTube queue for later.
Oh, my gosh. It is. So to the audience, he does a great job of explaining what we should care and worry about in the disclosures that came out from Snowden. And he does it, of course, in a very, very funny way. And he talks about all the reasons none of us understand it, and we can't possibly pay attention to it. So then he actually flies to Russia and meets with Snowden. It's A, hysterical. It's B, profane. But C, hysterical, the way he does it, because he picks the one thing everybody is actually worried about and then has Snowden answer by document, by all these different procedures that are going on, which one of them would allow that one thing to happen. And the fact that I have a clean tag is why I'm not telling you what he's doing. It is hysterical. It is wonderful. It actually made me appreciate Snowden more. You know, I've not been a big proponent, but listening to him, he's pretty well spoken. It's a very, very interesting interview. It's long, but it's riveting. It's just fantastic. Very funny too.
Look forward to that later then. Yeah, no, I loved Oliver when he did The Daily Show while Jon Stewart was away. Mm-hmm. And now that I've discovered that his full shows are on YouTube, pretty much from what I can see,
yeah,
I'm going to have a lot of fun. So anyway,
so
that's our sorbet.
Yeah, last week tonight. Okay, good. I feel my palate cleansed.
So now we can get stuck into Security Light.
Oh, jeez. Okay, that's just a break. Okay.
I have another one for later, though. It's okay. You get the cleaner palette twice. So Firefox have updated a release and a very important update to 37.0.2. I don't mention every Firefox update, but this one allows for remote code execution, or rather, it fixes a bug that allows for remote code execution.
Okay.
So I would say to do this one and not to dawdle about it.
Okay.
Last week, we talked about root pipe.
Yeah.
And that it was fixed in iOS 10.10.3. Yeah, it turns out not so much. It still broke it.
Oh.
Now, the only reason this is the reason it's insecurity light is because it had been released through responsible disclosure. So that means that not everyone knows how to do it. And the guy is talking to Apple. So hopefully we get another update from Apple before any bad stuff happens.
Okay.
And also, if you run as a non-admin account, you're safer. So maybe do that.
Okay.
Although that is a case of do as I say, not as I do, to be perfectly honest. Obviously, bashing Twitter must be great fun because facts don't seem to enter into it. So the whole internet exploded this week because Twitter was going to let anyone DM you.
Right.
That is true. It is opt-in. Not opt-out, opt-in. So there is
Thank you.
This is a feature for people who run a company who want to be able to get their customers to DM them.
Yeah, perfect example is you're whining about Ford because something went wrong with your car and you're whining on Twitter. Ford has to say, could you please DM me so that I can respond and help you out? Well, now that you could just DM them directly without having a problem.
Yeah, right now they have to follow you. You have to follow them. Then you can have a conversation. Whereas now you can just have a conversation with that brand or whatever. It's very useful for those kind of people and something I will never turn on for my account. But that's fine. It's optional. It's great.
Yeah.
I think, you know. It's forward thinking. Good idea, Twitter, but the internet went nuts. So I thought we should clear that up.
Great.
Also on Twitter have announced they're having they have been quite getting serious of late about trying to deal with abuse on Twitter. And they've now announced a new algorithm that's going to try to nip it in the bud, literally. So if someone who is not following you sends you an abusive at message, if the algorithm is working, you'll never see it. It'll get filtered out before it arrives to you. Now, if you go to that person's stream, it will be there. So it's not that the tweet is being censored. It's just that you know the way, like if someone asks you, it sort of goes into your feed. Well, that's not happening. But if you go to their feed, it's still there. And also, if it's one of your followers, or one of the people you follow, rather, the algorithm doesn't interfere. It assumes that you're just having a, I don't know what it assumes, but it doesn't get in the way of people you're actively following.
Interesting. If a troll tweets in the woods, right?
And the nice thing, if you never see it, have they tweeted?
Yeah, exactly. Well, and the nice thing is that usually when people are being especially abusive, they're creating new accounts to do it, so they can't be tracked, and that which means they don't have any followers. So they really are trolling in the woods with nobody. Yeah, that's kind of a nice.
It's an interesting
idea. Should work. Yeah,
so they're going to have to tweak their filters a bit, and hopefully there won't be too much fallout in terms of peripheral sort of stuff getting blocked that shouldn't. But again, it's not a really bad block. So I think it strikes the balance reasonably.
Even
if algorithms are always a bit, computers are dumb, but I think this is probably for the better.
Right. Hey, just to slow us down even more, that site that you gave us on AF Networking to see whether certain apps were vulnerable, I got one on my second hit. Citibank apps called City on Campus. It's not the big Citibank. It's cool. They show you this is the one app, and it actually gives you a link to it over in iTunes so you can see whether it's the one you're worried about.
Okay.
But just a major bank. Citibank's huge.
My experience with IT in banks is that it is stuck in the past and generally not very forward-thinking or good.
Well, only because of things you taught me was I able to tell my credit union that that they weren't using HTTPS on their login page.
But you shouldn't have to tell them that.
Well, exactly. Okay, here's bad news. I just typed in Bank of America. Their mobile banking and iPad apps, both of them, vulnerable. This is bad. This is really bad.
I shouldn't be surprised. I shouldn't be surprised, but I am.
But go check your apps for sure. This is okay. All right, we cleanse our palate. Go back to security. Important security news.
Okay, so we're still in important security news. We have some PSAs now to end with. It seems to be a thing now. WordPress users, again, over a dozen plugins, some of them quite prominent, including a Google Analytics one and Jetpack, have been updated to fix a fairly dangerous cross-site scripting bug that could allow people to basically take over your WordPress by stealing your login cookie or just injecting code into your site.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Does this explain the notifications I've been getting from Bluehost this week that are saying, hey, please update this plugin?
Yes, actually, if you read the text of those emails, that is exactly what they're talking about. They're talking about exactly this. Also, WordPress itself got an update too. So while you're updating your plugins, update those too. Or update WordPress itself, too.
Okay, you said that was not a security update, though, right? 4.2?
No, no. So there is... Okay, so there was a security update that came out, and there was an enhancement update. The two are not the same.
Oh, okay. All righty. I did both. No, update.
Yes, but anyway, there's no point. 4.2 is fine, so you can update to that. Also, another PSA then for owners of D-Link routers. There is a security bug in your firmware. D-Link are working on a fix. Keep an eye out for an updated firmware for your router, and when it comes out, apply it. More details in the show notes.
My daughter was really confused this week when we wrote to her and said, hey, does Nolan have a router? And she was really confused because I was talking about a wood router. It's like, to, should have been more specific.
This is why we call them routers in this country. So a router is for routing internet traffic and a router is for taking holes out of wood.
Oh, that's a good idea.
So I've never gotten confused between those two unless I talk to Americans and then I never know what I'm doing. Whether I'm sending traffic or making holes in wood.
Probably more likely to be routing traffic, right?
Me, probably, yeah.
All right.
So I did do woodwork in school and I was quite good at it. But anyway, the final one is, maybe some of our listeners are affected by this. There is a very commonly used e-commerce platform that you buy from eBay to run your own online shop. And there was a security update released in February. It's now April, for goodness sake. There are still 100,000 websites online today running this software in an out-of-date version that's vulnerable to all sorts of evil stuff. Mm. Who are these people and why aren't you updating your shop?
Wow.
So it's Magento is the software. If you're listening and you run a website that's powered by Magento, please update it. But yeah.
So. Okay.
Notable breaches. Costa Coffee Club. Apparently it's common in the UK. And then in terms of suggested reading, I just want to highlight some stuff. Remember last week we talked about ad blocking and the morals of it. There was an interesting story caught my eye this week, given we'd had that conversation. A German court has found that Adblock Plus is legal.
Okay.
Some German newspapers were suing Adblock Plus for blocking ads on their websites, and they lost the court case. And they're not happy.
That's in also, Germany.
Correct. So basically what Adblock Plus are saying is this is a useful precedent, and they can now use the same legal arguments elsewhere. But of course, the German court doesn't have jurisdiction elsewhere. So it's interesting in terms of, well, for German people and everywhere else, because, you know, when a court finds something, that has weight in other courts, even if it isn't determinative. So it's an interesting discussion, and details in the show notes. I also thought we should point out two rival op-eds, and I love this idea. So Ars Technica got one guy to explain why having a Tor router is a bad idea from a security point of view, and then the next week they got a guy to explain why it's a good idea. And so they're both excellent pieces from, you know, making the opposite arguments. And so I think if you actually care about this stuff, read both and you have a really well-rounded view of things.
Okay.
So dueling up it. Oh, that was cool. There's also Microsoft are trying to deal with the whole trust us with your data problem. So they've announced something called Lockbox, which sounds interesting, even if I am a bit skeptical about it. So that's in the show notes. And there's also there's other stuff in there too. I'll leave it to people's.
I don't know why you're taking so long today, Bart.
Yeah, it's not like I'm being interrupted. To cleanse our palate before we go SSHing, it has been 25 years since the Hubble telescope launched, believe it or not. And of all of the millions of squillions of pictures it has taken, probably the one that's caught our eye the most over time has been the Pillars of Creation image. It's really quite breathtaking, especially when you know what's happening. So one of those photographs where the more you know about what it shows, the more interesting it becomes. And whenever someone says something daft like, "Ooh, scientists have no appreciation for beauty," I just say, "Look at this image. Now understand it. Now it's become more beautiful." So anyway, there is a remastered version of that image been released. And I've linked to Vox.com, who have like a little hover thing over the image. So the image itself is obviously gorgeous. But when you hover over the points, it explains the science of what's happening in those few pixels.
Oh, cool.
And really, it's a magical image. And so I would highly recommend people, you know, give themselves 10 minutes or so to just absorb that picture. It is amazing.
I'm going to add a link to the show notes to a movie that was just put out called Invisible Universe Revealed. It's a documentary that was put out on PBS that is all about the Hubble Space Telescope and tells you from beginning to end everything it's done.
And is that available to like non-US people?
I don't know the answer to that. I'm going to put a link. It's on this link is on space.com, and it has a play button that I won't hit while I'm doing it. It's about an hour long special, but I was so anxious during this when they found out that it was that the lens was out of focus and what a horrible day. And actually, I don't talk much about the company I worked for, but it's a company called Hughes Aircraft Company. And my memory and Steve's memory are that it was our fault.
Eep.
And
it all went well, but eep.
Yeah. But in this, they blame Kleiner Perkins, I think, is who they said.
Oh, wow.
And,
much better.
Yeah, but I don't understand the connection. I'm sure it's in there somewhere, but anyway, they didn't blame us. They didn't throw us under the bus when they probably should have. But anyway, I'll put a link to that in the show notes, and hopefully you can see it. It's fabulous.
I hope so, because that really sounds like something I'd enjoy watching.
Oh yeah, we just watched it last night. I would watch it again. It's not as good as Particle Fever, but it's up there.
I still haven't been able to get my hands on a legal copy of Particle Fever. I'm cranky about that.
I thought I gave it to you.
No, you wanted to, but there was no way to.
Okay, we'll have to go back into research that, because I know you can. Actually, can you get into Netflix? Probably not.
It's not on our Netflix. I searched
recently because it wasn't a while ago. Oh poop. Okay. All right. Well, we will continue to pursue that.
Podcast mentioned how wonderful it was, and I remember how much you loved it. So I'm going to check on Netflix, and it wasn't.
I have bought it 3 times, so maybe I'll just burn it to a DVD and mail it to you.
Yay! I have a Region 2 player, so I can play anything.
Okay.
Or a Region 1 player. I have multiple external DVD players in the multiple different regions. That's how I've decided to solve that problem.
Why not? That's a good idea. All right, Bart, we ought to be SSHing by now. It's 24 minutes.
It's okay. This is the shortest of the SSH ones.
Good.
We're wrapping up. We're finishing off with just a little bit of optimization, a little bit of saving ourselves some energy, just to make our use of SSH a little bit easier. At this stage, we know why we want to. We know what we can do with it. And now we're just going to make our lives a little bit easier before we finish up.
Okay.
So in effect, this is all about bookmarks. Now, they're not really called bookmarks, but as far as I'm concerned, the effect of all of these things is to make it easier for you to do things, which I think is bookmarking. So we're going to do it on the command line, and then we're going to talk briefly about some GUI apps that I happen to use and like.
Okay.
So every time you run an SSH command, what SSH actually does in the background, and it takes a millisecond or two because they're computers and they're fast, is it looks to see if you have an SSH config file defined. And specifically, first it looks for a system-wide SSH config file, which it would be in /etc/ssh/ssh_config, should it exist. And then it looks in your home directory for one called /.ssh/config. And if that file exists, it looks in there to see if there's an entry in that file for the computer name you're trying to connect to. And if there is, it will use all the information in there to make the connection. And so what that means is that if you always use the same username and so forth to go to a certain host, you can just stick that stuff in the config file, and then you'll never have to type it again.
Oh, okay.
So the config file allows you to, instead of saying, minus username, minus all these kind of things, you can just put it all in the config file and then just SSH to the computer, and it'll pick up all the details from the config file. So let's look at how they work. They're wonderfully simple files, and a little secret, myself and Alison used one of these last week, because I don't run my SSH server that Alison played on last time. I don't run it on the standard port. And therefore, I gave Alison this file and said, install this file, I'll tell you about it next week. And Alison did.
And in a really, yeah, I think you're the one doing the trusting that you let somebody as careless as I am into your server, but you were watching as we did it. As I
was watching, yes. So Alison has already used one of these files, and hopefully by the end of this, I'll have convinced you that it's worth taking 5 or 10 minutes to set them up and then saving yourself time forevermore.
Okay.
So the syntax is very straightforward. So the file you're going to use, you're not going to do it at a system level chance. You're going to do it in your own home directory because that's just easier. So /.ssh/config is the file name. So you'd open that in your favorite text editor. And then to create a bookmark effectively for any particular host, so if you remember, the commands are always SSH user at some name. So whatever that some name is what is going to be searched for in this file. So you start off a section by saying host with a capital H and then whatever some name is. And then you follow that with options one line at a time saying what you want to set for that host. It's purely a convention, but you generally indent the option so that you can sort of look down the file and see where a new host starts.
Hmm.
But you don't have to. That's just being tidy. And if you'd like to throw in some comments, you just start the line with the pound sign, as you guys call it, or the hash symbol, as we call it.
Okay.
Each option then is, you can specify it in one of three ways. So you can say option name space option value, but that will only work if there's no spaces in the option value. If there are spaces, then you can say option name space and then inside double quotes, whatever the value is with all its spaces. Or you can say option name equals and then the value with all its spaces in it.
Okay.
But usually there's no spaces, so to be honest, option name space option value.
Okay. So there but we don't know what option we don't know what yeah. the options are, right?
We will in a moment.
Okay.
So there are lots of them is the first thing I will say. Pretty much anything you can do with SSH you can configure in these option in these config files. So if you want to see everything, there's actually a man page only for this config file. So it's man SSH underscore config and it will tell you everything about this config file. That's actually something we probably haven't mentioned before, that a lot of man pages are about files, not about commands.
I didn't know
so
that.
If, yeah. And you'll often see at the bottom of a man page a list of other man pages that are related to it. And so if you look at the SSH one, you'll see that there's an entry for SSH underscore config.
Okay.
So I'm going to look at just the ones that relate to the stuff we've talked about.
All right.
And so the first and almost obvious one is user with a capital U. Specify the username you'd like to use. So if you put, say, host, you know, whatever, Bart's web server, and then on the next line, user Allison, then you could just type SSH Bart's web server and not put username at because it will find that in the config file.
Hmm. Okay.
The next one is probably the single most commonly used one is port with a capital P, which is the one we used last week because my server is not on port 22. So instead of you having to type that every time, I made you say host and then the name of my web server, port, and then the port number. Which meant that you could just type SSH Allison at my web server and it would automatically go to the right port.
So we didn't put my password in that, though. All we have is host, your web server, and then port and the real port.
Right, because the passwords are taken care of by the SSH keys.
Mm. Right.
So this is okay. In addition to, right?
Okay. That's what I was getting stuck on was I thought I'd see that in here. I forgot about those key files. Okay, got it.
The next one is actually really cool. You can specify the real host name. And this is what really turns these into bookmarks. So you could say SSH Steve PC, and as long as you had a host name option in here, that would work because you would say the host name for Steve PC is actually Steve's IP address or stevepc.localdomain or whatever the actual name of Steve's PC is.
Would he have to have a static IP if I did a by IP though, right?
Yes. Yeah, okay. Whatever it is you put in there would obviously have to stay the same. So it's probably more useful actually for your web server, which you can also SSH to. You might have a shortcut, you know, Podfeed Web or something. So you just say SSH Podfeed Web, and it would know that that was actually the full address or the IP address of your web server.
Okay.
So you can literally make little bookmarks. So you can give them a little alias.
Nice.
Then all the stuff we talked about last week, all of that X11 forwarding and stuff, you can configure all of that in here too. So you could say forward X11 equals yes, and that is equivalent to minus capital X. And you can say forward X11 trusted equals yes, which is equivalent to minus capital Y. You can say the local forward port number space host colon port, and that's your minus capital L for port forwarding. And your minus capital D is dynamic forward space port number. So everything we did last week, you could also do in these files. Let's make it a bit more specific, though. So the single most important, the most likely reason you are to need one of these files, rather than to want one, but to need one, is if you're doing OrSync over SSH and the port number is not 22. Because the SSH command, you're going to say minus P port number, and that will work fine. But the OrSync command doesn't allow you to specify a port. So the only way you can make a certain port be used if you're doing OrSync is with one of these files. So I have an example in the show notes. So imagine you have a server called myorsyncserver.com and it's running on port 2222. The only way you're going to orsync to there is if you create one of these files and have in it host space myorsyncserver.com port 2222.
That isn't an obscure possibility.
I come across it quite regularly, actually. It's one of those questions that you often see asked where people say, so I've moved my SSH off port 22 because I was getting lots of script kiddies attacking my server. And now I can't do my backups anymore. Oh, okay. Help.
Okay.
And this is the answer.
Does that really stop the script kiddies from trying?
Most just of those because attacks are automated. It? They're just checking the internet for port 22.
Well, I know, but if they're not getting through, why would they would still be checking for port 22, wouldn't they, whether I moved it or not?
Yeah, but there's no, if you move it, there's nothing on port 22.
Yeah, but
so
if,
they can't possibly guess your username and password. Because
okay, so you're saying it's a way of making it less likely they could crack in. It right. doesn't stop them from trying.
Correct, but it will look it. To okay. them like you don't have SSH.
Oh, okay. But since it's automated, they won't stop trying.
Correct, but what it does, so I've noticed this in my log files. If I leave my SSH on port 22, I see like 100 attempts a day.
Okay.
To log in with, you know, as user, and you see them trying, you know, user Bob, user Allison. Actually, Allison's in there, Allison.
I should probably stop doing that.
Yeah, so all these common names like Bob and Allison, and actually Bart is in there too, which is annoying. But really all of these common names, and they just try to log in with common passwords. And so if once you move it off 22, it just goes to effectively to zero.
Why does it go to zero? If it's automated, they should keep trying.
Well, no, because what they're doing is they're trying every IP on port 22. They're not trying every port on each IP because there's 60-something thousand ports. It would take forever. So if they don't find you on 22, they give up.
Well, why do they give up? You'd think they... Well,
because the internet... Okay, because it's like you don't have to outrun the bear. You just have to outrun all the weaker people.
Okay. No, I'm just... I guess I'm confused as I picture if I've got an automatic script running, it's not actually getting information back that something didn't work. But maybe it does. Maybe once this script kiddie...
Well, no. So the way it would work is that they're not targeting you, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're targeting... They're just trying to find people with open SSH servers.
Right, but so if why would they stop you, trying to port. Find you? Why? So script kiddie A tries port 22. How does that stop script kiddie B from trying port 22? They would still try.
You're right, it doesn't. What I'm saying is if you move it off 22, you don't see any tries anymore. Because they're still trying you, but you're not even logging it because it hasn't achieved anything.
You're not logging it. Thank you. That's what I was looking for.
It never reached
it's still happening.
Price, right?
It doesn't stop it from happening. It just stops you from having to see it and think about it.
Right. Yeah, because, yes.
Got it.
Computer,
okay.
Port 22 isn't even open. No connection is ever made. Nothing happens.
Okay. I'm with you now.
Okay, sorry. Sorry. I should have been clear about that. So that's why you might need one of these files. But I'm saying to you that even if you don't need one, maybe you want one.
I want one. I don't have one.
So the example I have given in the show notes is imagine you have an awkwardly named server, which I have called thisisareallylongname.com. And imagine it's running in port 2222 and that the sysadmin doesn't like you and gave you the username of rhododendron, which is hard to spell. Right? Possible?
We used to name our servers after fish back when there were fewer of them, and I insisted that one be called Humu Humu Nuku Nuku Apua'a.
Oh my God.
And then we gave it to somebody we didn't like.
We have a policy of herbaceous plants. Well, of plants, basically.
Right.
And it has been a running joke for the last 10 years that I want to give someone a server called Rhododendron, but I have been told I may not. Anyway.
All right.
So if you had this, if the system didn't like you, you would have to type SSH rhododendron at thisisareallylongname.com -P2222.
Every time you SSH.
Long and annoying.
Don't you just get a text expander snippet for that?
That will be one solution.
Okay.
Another solution will be to use one of these little files, which in which case I could reduce that whole thing to SSH my server. And the exact syntax to do that is shown there. So host my server, host name, thisisareallylongname.com, user, rhododendron, port 2222.
Look at that. Look at that. That's fun.
So effectively, the hostname directive lets you create little aliases or nicknames for your servers.
I like it.
Now, the final bit of magic here is that the host directive accepts wildcards.
Hmm.
So it accepts two of them. It accepts star, which means zero or more of anything, or question mark, which means exactly one of anything. Now, the most useful one is a star. So imagine you work for a large organization and you have the same username on every server in that organization's domain. You could say host star.mycompany.com, user, whatever your username is, and then you just never have to type the username. You just go SSH on whatever computer you want to go to.
Cool.
There we go. So that
I like
is
it. I like it.
Yeah, that is SSH config files. They're not complicated. Sometimes you will need them, but even if you don't, they may save you a lot of effort. So I thought we should talk about them.
Yeah, that I could definitely see the use of that. I'm trying to think. You know, I've had trouble with things like where I've tried to, when I had my VPN server set up at my house and I wanted to come in from the outside and then get to a file on, say, Steve's PC, Steve's Mac, and I couldn't because I didn't know where it was. But if I had set up one of these config files on my Mac, it would have known, it would be storing that information that I figured out when I was sitting at home.
Yes, exactly. So, because you'll have made the bookmark and then it'll keep working. Yeah.
Right.
So you don't have to remember. Your computer's remembering. And they're better at that. Well, they're better at that than I am, anyway. So the obvious second thing we should mention here is that this same functionality can be achieved in another way. There are many SSH GUI clients out there, and they allow you to create little bookmarks where you put in all the information, and then it just give it a name, and then you just click on the name, and hey presto, it all works automatically. And I was too lazy to, slash really couldn't be bothered, to check out every single one on the planet and try to tell you which one is best. So what I thought I'd do instead is just tell you the ones that I actually use.
Okay.
And in the case of two of them, the ones I actually spent my money on. So I have some skin in the game. So the first one I use, which is, I have these in the order of how often I use them, actually. So the one that I use day in, day out on all of my Macs, at home and in work, is Jellyfish with two S's.
So Jellyfish. I just checked, and you must have told us about that a long time ago, because when I went to buy it, it said I already owned it, so I just downloaded it again.
I am sure if at some stage you ever asked me what app should I use, I'm sure I told you that. It's €3.49 in the OS X App Store. It used to be free, but actually I think it used to be free, and then the developer kind of said, I really didn't have time for this, and then someone went, why don't you make some money? And I went, oh, that's a good idea. And so now it's a cheap app, and I think that's just fine. I think developers deserve money.
Yeah, that's only $4 in US money.
Yeah, which is, you know, two cups of coffee, or one very big cup of coffee with fancy stuff in it. Right?
That's right. That's what I get.
So it's not the world's most complicated app, because what it actually does is it uses Terminal.app app to create the actual windows where you're SSHing into. So it is literally just managing your bookmarks.
Hmm.
Anything we could set in those in that config file, we can set through this GUI, including all the X11 forwarding and the port forwarding and all that kind of stuff. And what I really like about it is that it allows you to specify different color schemes and stuff for each terminal window. And so at the very most simplistic level, what I do is live servers, which I should not blow up, are bright red. Test servers that I may blow up are bright green.
Okay, that's funny.
Honestly, it really works, because mnemonic is, if I'm on a red background with white text, tread carefully. If I'm on a green background, have at it. It's
great. Yeah, that's what it's there for, right?
Right.
And
the other thing which I have actually taken the time to do, especially in work, is you can specify a custom background image. And so I have a template that I use where I have the server name in massive writing. It's only like a 10% opacity or something, but it's in massive writing across the whole window. And then an icon in the top right corner that's also very opaque, very transparent, of the OS, which means that when you go into Quick Look and all of your windows zoom down to tiny size, those really dim things become really visible, and you can just click to the right server.
Oh, that's really tricky.
Yeah, and so because it's almost transparent, it doesn't distract you from the actual text you're working on in the terminal. It's just when you zoom out, it becomes obvious.
Oh, that's a slick idea. So is that the main reason you would use a tool like Jellyfish instead of writing these up by hand in the terminal?
That and the fact that it pops a little icon in your menu bar where you can just click on it and then click on the name of the server.
Okay.
And what it also does is it lets you group your shortcuts. So I have a group called DNS servers, a group called file servers, a group called... Well, I have lots of groups.
So it's easier jump into one.
Exactly. So I just go click DNS server, that's the one I want, and away you go.
Okay, very
cool. So that's why I use it. It is because
faster.
Of the custom skinning, and because it gives me a nice quick launcher for my SSH windows. And I spend an awful, awful lot of time in SSH windows. Honestly, my desk, there is at least four of them open at any one time.
Wow.
And I have a 27-inch Mac, so they're well spread out. Lots of room. The other one, the next one that I would use the most commonly is basically I would only use it when I'm traveling, but nonetheless, there are times you need it. And when you need it, it's absolutely invaluable, is an iOS app called Prompt 2 from our good friends at Panic Software, who we keep on plugging for the simple reason they make great software. This one is €4.99, so I'm guessing that's probably $5.99 or something. Dollars. $5.50 or something.
That's if you in iTunes. Bring it up. $4.99.
Huh. Oh, interesting.
Same price. Yeah.
Which means more expensive for us because that's more than $5. Anyway.
Yeah.
Again, it's a beautifully made app because that's what Panic are good at. So your typical keyboard in iOS is not actually very SSH friendly because you need a lot of control C's and all these kind of things, and there is no control key on iOS.
Right.
But basically, this app just adds extra UI that allows you to do things like hit the control key, hit the escape key, and also actually it puts the symbols you use most often up there for you so they don't actually have to get them in the keyboard. And that would be particularly pipe is obviously spectacularly handy because that's awfully messy to find in the iOS keyboard.
Right, right.
And so it's just basically they have taken, and tab. Tab is another one that's very important that you're not going to just find in the iOS keyboard. So what they've done is they've elegantly worked around the shortcomings of iOS when it comes to these kind of things. And so I think it's worth every cent of its $4.99.
Huh. If you haven't gotten around to buying Transmit for your iOS device and you were thinking about it, you can get them as a bundle and you save $1. Oh, so instead of $14, it's $13 for the two.
That's a good price for two high-quality apps.
So I'm going to ask you a really dumb question. You're sitting there your iPad. You're at work. You're on the Wi-Fi network with your iPad, and you can use Prompt to SSH into your servers from there.
So imagine I'm traveling. I'm not anywhere near a real computer because I will always prefer to use a real QWERTY keyboard for SSHing. Sure. So I'm out, I'm away. I'm somewhere. I'm at a conference. I'm God knows where. I could be in the air on Wi-Fi. Mm-hmm. And something is broken. Magic smoke has come out of something, or something has crashed. I need to go in and fix something. Step one, a VPN into work.
Okay.
And iOS can VPN just fine. Step two, SSH to server. It wouldn't work without step one because we're not that insecure.
I guess that was a stupid question. No.
But my own servers, right? My own web server is accessible from anywhere, so I could just SSH straight to it from my iPad. Yeah.
Okay.
Or my iPhone. It's a universal app, I should say.
Right, now, good point.
I much prefer a QWERTY keyboard. I'll tolerate an iPad. It'd want to be a serious emergency before I get my iPhone out to SSH. Just saying.
Well, that's because you like those little itty-bitty phones. Maybe an iPhone 6 Plus. You never know.
No. And then the final one I should mention is probably the one I've used for the most years, but I don't use very often these days because I hate Windows, is PuTTY, P-U-T-T-Y, which is a Windows client that has been around forever. In fact, their website looks like someone teleported it from the 1980s. Not even the 90s. This is 80s. It is white text on a black background. There is not an image in sight. It's the most old-fashioned thing you ever see. But it's a lovely little SSH GUI. And, of course, Windows doesn't even have SSH by default. So it's the GUI and the actual SSH libraries all in one. And what's really great is there's no installer. It's just putty.exe. Just put it somewhere you like, even a thumb drive, and click on it.
And
away you go. It is an old self-contained putty.exe. It's lovely. And the same people, so it's an open source project as well, so it's free. And the same people also have, because Windows doesn't have secure copy, SCP, or SFTP. So there's actually a pscp.exe and a psftp.exe to give you SCP and SFTP on your DOS prompt. And also a pagent.exe to give you SSH agent for saving your passwords on Windows.
Hmm.
So again, lovely little project. And you can download it all from the PuTTY download page. So they are the clients I actually use.
Those are great recommendations. I like that you gave kind of a variety there in keeping our Windows brethren involved as well.
And, you know, as much as I avoid using Windows computers, it happens.
And there's people who like them.
I know. I'm just saying from my point of view.
No accounting for taste, but no. Yeah, I didn't say that.
You're even more mean than I was.
Yeah, I did, Chris.
but when I'm there, I need to SSH, and PuTTY is fantastic.
I think I actually used PuTTY back in the day.
Sure you did. Yeah, almost every nerd has PuTTY at some stage. It's a rite of passage.
Putty's a verb now. Puttied.
I think it is.
All right.
So at this stage, we've wrapped up our SSHing. So we now know how to do passwordless authentication. We know how to use config files to save ourselves from typing. We can run commands remotely. We can transfer files. We can do an awful lot all through the magic of SSH. And so we're done with SSH now. I think we've given it a good go.
We've run it through, huh?
We have, you know, we've looked at all, you know, it does more, but really this is the stuff you're going to need.
Yeah. It was fun.
Yeah. So zooming back a bit to the bigger picture. So this SSH sub-series is sitting within our bigger networking series.
Mm-hmm.
And in that networking series, we've been making our way through the stacks and the protocol. And so SSH was the first of the layer 4 protocols, or the application layer protocols, that we've really gotten stuck into. And boy, howdy did we get stuck into it. So we're leaving SSH, but we're not leaving the application layer. So we're going out of SSH and stepping sideways, staying in the same big picture zone, which is application layer networking stuff. And in the next installment, we're going to look at terminal commands for talking HTTP and HTTPS. Because we don't tend to think of the web as being a texty, terminally thing, but it can be. And so that is where we're going next.
That sounds like fun. I've really enjoyed the SSH series. I'm not sure I have a daily need for it, but I've enjoyed the learning. It's really, really cool. This was fun.
Excellent. Okay, well, I think that's where we leave it for today. I presume 2 weeks, the usual rotation?
I believe so, last I checked. Hey, okay, we didn't even go over time. Wow.
Oh, ye of little faith.
All right,
anyway,
Mark.
So until 2 weeks from now, happy computing.
All right, well, I promised a shorter show and still an hour and a half. What are you going to do? It was great content. We had so much fun this week. And I actually cut stuff out of the show live during the show. The live audience can verify that. Anyway, that is going to wind us up for this week. Many thanks to our sponsor for helping pay the bills, makers of Clarify over clarify-it.com. Do not forget to send in your dumb questions, comments, and suggestions by emailing me at allison@podfeet.com. Follow me on Twitter @podfeet. And don't forget to get a hold of Donald Burr. Link in the show notes, of course, to his email address to become part of the beta testers for the live show app on iOS. And by the way, he told me I was allowed to say there might be an Apple Watch app involved in that whole program. Anyway, also go check out the NoSillaCast Google Plus community over at podfeet.com/Google+. Having a great time over there. I post a lot of questions. I post blog stuff in the middle of the week. A lot of good content. George has always got some crazy story going on, so it's a lot of fun. If you want to join in the fun of the live show, like, Nth Mike did for the first time in forever, or actually for the first time ever, I should say, you can go to podfeet.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time and join the friendly and enthusiastic NoSilla Castaways. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.